Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the U.S.-Mexican War shape the future of American politics and diplomacy? While the conflict gets less attention from Americans today than other wars, it resulted in a vast expansion of the territory under U.S. control, foreshadowed the coming of the Civil War, and catalyzed the country's first true anti-war movement. So how did it happen that American troops challenged Mexico and won, and that within this country, animosities put in place by the conflict were still raging long after the fighting had ended? Amy S. Greenberg is Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of History and Women's Studies at Penn State University and author of the new book, A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. Amy, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how Americans in general and politicians specifically began talking about the fact that there was a great deal of land that was technically possessed by Mexico that was quite attractive and might be good for expanding according to the tenets of Manifest Destiny.
Well, actually, there was interest in the United States in the land that later became the American Southwest. Even before Mexico got control of the land through independence from Spain in the 1820s. In the 18-teens, presidents looked to Texas and thought it looked appealing, and California was of great interest to expansionists and to politicians and to businessmen, going really back to the 1820s.
And there was this idea with California in particular that if we didn't take it, somebody else might.
Absolutely. Expansionists in American history kind of always pointed to the threat that particularly Britain posed in terms of American interests, arguing that if the United States didn't take desirable territories, then other countries, particularly Britain, would come in and they would take that land, and suddenly our wonderful continental position where we were sort of insulated from the dangers of European nations would be compromised.
Was that a realistic threat? I mean, I think about it's theoretically possible, but the sort of ability to manage territory that was so far away seems that it would have been really a challenge for Great Britain, not that they didn't do it in other parts of the world.
Well, you know, this is really a great question, and scholars have written a lot about Anglophobia in this time period and argued, you know, variously that people really did see it as a fear. But what's interesting is when you look at the diplomatic correspondence coming out of England itself, they really aren't interested in taking California. So, you know, practically speaking, the threat was not realistic. The British didn't see it as necessarily in their interest to take it. Some people in England thought, you know, it would be nice to have it, but certainly there were no British designs on California of the sort that democratic expansionists kept claiming that there were.
So what sort of place was Mexico in the first decades following its own independence from Spain?
Well, Mexico came out of their revolution really in terrible, terrible economic and social shape. It was really, you know, in some ways, an independent Mexico looked a little bit like an independent United States a few decades before, in that a lot of people had sacrificed a lot to overthrow a colonial oppressor, but Mexico's population was decimated by the Wars of Independence. There was a tremendous amount loss of life. Agriculture was damaged by the independence movement. Economically, it was really pretty much of a disaster, and also really socially fractured, not unified at all in the way that the United States were when they became independent in the 1780s. So Mexico was this nation, you know, in some ways a name only, composed of a large number of independent Indians who really didn't see themselves as Mexicans, saw themselves as members of tribal entities first and foremost. A small proportion of Creoles who were wealthy and, you know, to a certain degree weren't entirely convinced that Mexico was a great idea being an independent republic. You know, some people actually thought a monarchy might be in their interests. So it was a politically fragmented and economically really in bad shape nation.
Which is not so different, as you pointed out earlier, from the fledgling United States, where you had a collection of states where people felt more like, say, a Virginian or a Pennsylvanian than an American.
That's absolutely right, but the situation in Mexico was really much, much worse, I think, in large part because such a large proportion of the inhabitants of Mexico really were not, they didn't see themselves as Mexican. They saw themselves as Indians, as Mayans, as whatever their particular tribal entity was.
So when you talk about that Mexico as a sort of, at that point in its history, a nation in name only, was that used as justification by Americans who felt that it was within our right to potentially expand into that territory?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when expansionists look to Mexico, one thing they noted that I haven't talked about yet is that the areas of Mexico that expansionists were most interested in other words, the areas that were that bordered land that we already had through the Louisiana Purchase, those were the areas that were least settled. So the mass of the Mexican population was really concentrated around Mexico City, so in central Mexico, whereas the northern provinces were very sparsely populated, and Mexico City really didn't seem to care that much, that there weren't that many people in Texas and California, that the residents of those areas were not necessarily completely committed to remaining Mexican. And to American expansionists, it really didn't look like the residents of those areas or the central Mexican government, for that reason, were putting the lands to very good use. So, you know, there was this concept among American expansionists that really predated the Texas Revolution. It really, really went back to the 1780s, which was that the people who deserved to have land were people who were going to put that land to use. So in other words, to farm it, to make it productive, to put structures up on it. And if you owned land but you didn't actually improve it, these were basically called improvements, then you didn't really deserve the land, and that the land should belong to somebody who would improve it, who would make it fertile, who would, you know, build houses and roads and make it more inhabited according to what ideas of civilized inhabitation were at this time. So when expansionists looked to northern Mexico, they saw land that they thought Mexicans weren't doing anything with, and they saw land that they believed was occupied primarily by Indians, who they thought they would have no problem besting because they had their own history of defeating Indians, you know, in the continental United States. So they thought the Indians that were in Texas and in the Southwest would be equally easy to sort of get rid of, as, say, the Cherokee were in the southeast of the United States. And so, you know, this is what they saw when they looked at Mexico. So it's really not that much of a surprise that people made these really strong arguments that the U.S. should take over this land, the U.S. deserved the land, and that it really wouldn't be a problem taking that land from Mexico.
And I guess that's the same sort of thinking that underpinned westward expansion in the later part of the 19th century, by which the federal government made these land grants to settlers who wanted to go to different western states.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that process, you know, really predates Texas as well. So it goes back to the 1820s. It actually goes back to the 1790s, that the government is basically facilitating settlers to move into land that is actually owned by what were known at that time as dependent domestic nations. Mm-hmm. So Native American tribes, you know, federal or state governments would do various things in order to make it appealing for white American settlers to move into that land and improve it. Using the justification that that land wasn't being improved and that the people who owned it, the Indians, didn't deserve to have it.
Okay, so there were obviously Americans strongly opposed to this idea of expansion and what would become the U.S.-Mexican War. Tell us about Henry Clay and how he campaigned against that expansion and the effect that would have on the final time that he ran for president.
All right, so Henry Clay, you know, who's really, I think, one of the great figures of early 19th century history. People don't know that much about him because he never became president. And, you know, that's sad. He ran for president over and over again and kept losing. And had he become president, I think people would be more aware of what a sort of towering figure he was. But in the early 19th century, he actually was a really, really avid expansionist. He was a war hawk with the War of 1812 and firmly committed that we needed to go to war against England. It's not like he was an anti-war guy or anti-expansion. But in the 1840s, so Texas became independent in the 1830s, and in the middle of the 1840s, 1844, John Tyler, who was president, attempted to annex Texas, an independent Republic of Texas. And Henry Clay thought this was a bad idea for a number of reasons. It wasn't necessarily that he was opposed to expanding in a southwest direction, although as a member of the Whig Party, his interests really were in the Northeast and in industrializing the area of the United States that we already occupied. So he thought basically we should be putting our energies towards improving the land that we already had by building roads and canals and bridges and all these sorts of things that were called internal improvements at the time. He was a big champion of this. So, you know, and he thought we should build factories and we should put taxes or what were known as tariffs on imported goods in order to enable manufacturing at home. This is what he thought would make the United States great. He didn't think taking more land to the southwest was a way to make the United States great. He saw that as kind of a distraction from the real work that the United States needed to do. But, you know, I think all other things being equal, you know, getting more land to the southwest, it was not necessarily a terrible idea in his mind or in the mind of the Whig Party, which was the party that he ran. So he is the nominee in 1844 for the presidency. And when John Tyler negotiates a secret treaty to annex the Republic of Texas and bring it into the United States, Clay opposes this treaty and he opposes the annexation of Texas on several grounds. The main reason that he opposes the annexation of Texas, I think, is that Clay sees that Texas, which, by the way, is a slaveholding republic at this time, mm-hmm. if it comes into the United States, it's going to very much upset the kind of sectional balance, not just the sectional balance in the Senate, but a kind of uneasy situation in which Northerners and Southerners are really beginning to look at each other and wonder, you know, can we continue coexisting with one section of the country owning slaves and the other section not? Clay doesn't see bringing a giant, tremendous republic of slaveholders into the Union as being necessarily a great idea given this increasing sectional tension. So that's one reason. Another reason that he opposes the annexation of Texas is that Mexico had never recognized Texas's independence. When Texas became independent, it was General Santa Anna who signed a treaty basically allowing Texas independence, and Mexico's government never ratified the treaty. So in Mexico's eyes, Santa Anna was a discredited leader who had no right to basically give away Texas or to allow Texas independence to happen. So Mexico basically claimed that Texas was not independent. And there was a boundary dispute, which was of major importance to both Mexico and the United States.
Let me jump in here for a minute. We need to take a break, and we will talk about that boundary dispute in just a moment. My guest is Amy S. Greenberg. She's Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of History and Women's Studies at Penn State University. Her new book is called A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Amy S. Greenberg. She's Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of History and Women's Studies at Penn State University and author of the new book, A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So before the break, Amy, you were starting to tell us about this disputed boundary between the independent, sort of grudgingly seen, understood by Mexico to be independent, if not officially recognized, and the Texians said that border was the Rio Grande, and the Mexicans saw it as something very different.
Yeah, they believed it was an oasis. Mm-hmm. So Henry Clay, you know, he came out right before the election of 1844, and he made a public statement where he said, I don't think we should annex Texas. Leave Texas alone. We don't want to annex it because, like I said, not only did he think that this would increase sectional tension in the United States, he actually believed it would lead to war with Mexico. Mm-hmm. And he said as much. He said, you know what, and annexing Texas and war with Mexico are the same thing, and there's no reason for us to have a war with Mexico, and so we're not going to annex Texas right now. Sometime in the future, probably, but definitely not now. I oppose the annexation of Texas. And he ended up losing that election. I think it's pretty easy to say that the reason that Clay lost in 1844 is because he opposed Texas annexation, which was an extremely popular position with the American public. And his opponent, James K. Polk, embraced it.
What sort of influence did Clay have on the thinking of Abraham Lincoln, who had recently been elected to Congress?
Okay, so Abraham Lincoln absolutely worshipped Henry Clay. I don't think there's any question about that. Clay was his, Lincoln said, his beau ideal of a politician. He had a book of Clay's speeches that as a young man he used to read over and over again. And when he was first a rising politician in Illinois, he invited Clay to come talk. Clay couldn't come. But, you know, so Lincoln really sort of modeled himself on Henry Clay. The positions that mattered to him as a young man were Henry Clay's positions. They were internal improvements. It was having a stable banking system, putting tariffs in place on imported goods to increase American manufacturing. And he really, really believed the stuff that Henry Clay said and did. And, you know, he really liked Henry Clay. So what ends up happening, Abraham Lincoln, you know, he really, really wants to get to Congress. And there's a couple other Whigs who are pretty heavy contenders in his district. And Lincoln finally gets his chance to go to Congress. There's an election in 1846, and he wins it. And so, yay, you know, Lincoln's going to go to Congress. But unfortunately, this war with Mexico intervenes. Now, Abraham Lincoln had very, very little interest in what was happening in Mexico. And in fact, you know, he actually said about Texas at the time that Texas independence was being considered, he said, you know, he wrote a letter to a friend. He said, I don't really see what the big deal is about annexing Texas, because there's going to be the same number of slaves whether we annex Texas or not. So either the slaves will be part of the United States or they'll be in Texas, but it's not going to change how many slaves are out there. Lincoln was anti-slavery even at this point. So,
Clay was a slaveholder?
Yeah, Clay was a slaveholder, right? Mm-hmm. Clay's, he owns about 50 slaves mm-hmm. in Kentucky, which constantly caused problems for Clay as a politician. I mean, totally apart from the problems that it caused his slaves, that he had slaves, it caused Clay some problems because Northerners, especially abolitionists, really didn't trust Clay. Clay would say things like, slavery is terrible. I don't believe in slavery. I think slavery would be wrong. And in fact, Clay was the president of the American Colonization Society, which had this idea that if you could buy the slaves from the slaveholders and ship them to Africa, that would solve the problem of slavery in the United States. So Clay's idea of how you're going to solve slavery is to reimburse slaveholders for their property and send them all to Africa. But yeah, Clay owns 50 slaves. Abraham Lincoln doesn't own slaves. He actually married a woman, Mary Todd, who came from a slaveholding family, and he could own slaves if he wanted to, and he didn't, so he's anti-slavery. Lincoln, when he goes to Congress, he's entirely his plan is to talk about tariffs, again, these taxes. This is what he really wants to talk about. He wants to talk about the kind of tariffs that we can have to make America stronger. His platform is entirely economic when he is canvassing and running for Congress. But once the war starts, right after, when he starts running, basically it starts before he runs for Congress, because of the way elections were held then, there was actually 13 months between when he was elected and when he got to Congress. So basically, most of the war occurs after Lincoln's been elected to Congress, but before he gets there. But the point is that when Lincoln's thinking he's going to talk about tariffs, but the war becomes the main issue that anybody cares about in the United States. It's entirely encompassing, and nobody can really talk about anything else. So Lincoln takes this very circuitous route to get to Washington, D.C. from Springfield, Illinois, and he goes to Lexington, Kentucky, which is where Mary Todd's family is from, in order to visit his relatives there, many of whom he's never met before. And when his family shows up in Lexington, Henry Clay, who's the most famous resident of Lexington, and actually a good friend of Mary Todd's father, Clay is just getting ready to give his first big speech about the Mexican War since he lost the election to Polk. And so Lincoln is in this incredible, really wonderful situation for him, which is that he's never met Clay before. He's never actually heard Clay give a speech. Clay, by the way, is like the most outstanding orator of this time period. Everybody who heard him speak said he was just an incredible speaker. He had this wonderful voice, and people were actually moved to tears when he gave speeches. So, you know, Clay was just like an outstanding orator, and Lincoln had never heard him in person. So Lincoln shows up in Lexington with his wife, and he gets to go in the company of his father-in-law to hear Clay give this tremendous speech about the Mexican War. And the Whig Party had been asking Clay to make a big statement about the war for months, but Clay didn't. And he didn't for a number of reasons. You know, he was thinking about running for president again. He knew how much his statements about Texas had hurt him the time before. He had a lot of family problems to deal with. He was so defeated by what happened in 1844 with James K. Polk, who he thought was a nobody, beating him, that he had no interest in speaking out. But what ends up happening is that Clay's most promising son, his namesake, Henry Clay Jr., is killed at the Battle of Buena Vista in Mexico in February of 1847. And Henry Clay, upon learning that his son is killed, and Clay entirely opposed his son going to war, and his son was a Whig as well. A lot of Whigs who were opposed to Clay and his policies, like wealthy, powerful Whigs, volunteered for this war, which is kind of interesting compared to what you would see today. If there was a war today, you wouldn't see, I don't think necessarily, congressmen volunteering for the war or sons of congressmen volunteering for the war, certainly not in the numbers that there were then. So, but Henry Clay's son volunteers for the war, goes there and gets killed. And, you know, this, above all else, I think, is what makes Clay speak out. So Clay gives this incredibly moving speech in November of 1847 while Abraham Lincoln's in the audience, and Clay calls for an end to the war. And this, I think, is what really made Abraham Lincoln decide that once he got to Congress, what he was going to talk about was not going to be tariffs, it was going to be the war as well. So Clay making this really, like, tremendously brave and moving speech, which was basically it appeared in newspapers around the nation thanks to the newly invented telegraph. This leads Lincoln, when he gets to Congress, to stopping the war, like, his issue.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jimmy in Dallas. Hi, Jimmy.
Good day. Yes, yes.
Hi.
I'd like to I have a question, but a comment, too, that, of course, we declared manifest destiny and we moved into these territories from Purchase, Louisiana. Now, I understand it that there are already people thriving here in California under rule of Spain. Actually, they did not recognize Mexico or Texas or the United States, and they were thriving and had thriving ranchos, also farms, and doing very well and had developed the land very well and had these grants made to them from Spain.
That's correct.
Now,
do you want to follow up with your question?
Did the United States and or Mexico diminish these grants from those people that established them and did develop the land, which is a universal law. If you have the land and you can develop it, of course, it can belong to you. That's my question. How did those folks lose their land, and by what means?
Okay, so there was a wealthy group of Spaniards who were given tremendous grants of land. And, you know, you can call them rancheros or, you know, something of that sort. And these people who, you know, in some ways were a lot like really, really large plantation owners in the South at the same time, they owned tremendous tracts of land that weren't really developed very much, to tell you the truth. In Texas, they were mostly given over to ranching, and it's pretty much the same in California as well. And these, you know, Spanish-identified individuals, who, you're right, for the most part, really didn't care that much about Mexico. They didn't really care that much about who was in power. They led pretty comfortable lifestyles. They educated their kids in Europe. And they employed the forced labor of a lot of Indians in conditions that weren't really that different from slavery. Mexico mostly upheld those land grants. They didn't really have much choice in the matter. So most of the people keep their land in California and Texas under the land grants from Spain. When the United States comes in and takes over, it becomes an entirely different situation. Particularly in California. And you know what's kind of interesting when you look at the actual war is that a number of these rancheros, these Californios, like the De La Guerra family and, you know, Salsipuedes, you know, big families in California who were incredibly wealthy and had been for generations, a lot of them actually, or some of them, sort of tentatively support U.S. annexation. Like, it's not necessarily a given that these people, this is true in Texas too, actually, a lot of people in Texas, an author named Andres Resendez has written a book about this, a lot of people in Texas at the time of Texas independence are kind of interested in perhaps getting a tighter alliance with the United States because they don't necessarily feel like Mexico has been doing them any huge favors. So, you know, a lot of these people are kind of in a, you know, well, let's wait and see, or even maybe slightly more positive attitude towards, in the case of Texas, first independence, and then in the case of the U.S.-Mexico War, you know, getting on board with the United States. This is very wealthy people. But, you know, certainly in the case of California, almost all these people end up losing their land. And they end up losing their land, basically, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo is sort of unclear about what kind of land grants are going to be upheld by the United States. So it's almost deliberately vague. And, you know, the deal with these land grants that you're discussing from Spain is that it's not like anybody has a beautiful piece of paper which says, here is so-and-so's land grant from Spain that they're carrying around with them, like in the way that we would carry a passport. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they don't, it's not necessarily easy for them to prove that they own the land, even though it seems perfectly obvious that they do. And the U.S. court system takes all that land away from them because there's white American settlers who want it, and so it doesn't end up working out too great for those people.
Okay, so obviously President James K. Polk had access to the same kind of information that caused Henry Clay to think it's not a great idea to annex Texas, at least at this point. He knows about the disputed border, and in fact, that seems to have been a motivation, like a great reason to mass troops at that border and just wait for something to happen.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So, you know, Polk, he's the first dark horse candidate in American history. The Democratic opponent in 1844 was supposed to be Martin Van Buren, and very conveniently, Martin Van Buren also issued a letter opposing the annexation of Texas. So it's quite possible that there was some collusion between Clay and Martin Van Buren before the Whig and Democratic nominating conventions, where they got together and they were just like, you know what, this annexation of Texas is a terrible idea, let's just both oppose it, and then it won't be an issue in the election. But unfortunately, what happens is that the Democrats utterly overthrow Martin Van Buren once he opposes the annexation of Texas. And that's how James K. Polk ends up becoming the nominee. He is a person who, from a very early period, was a very adamant supporter of Manifest Destiny. He made many statements about how the U.S. claim to Texas was obvious and absolute. So Polk, you know, when he becomes president, it's basically on a platform that we're going to annex Texas, and we're going to expand as far as possible. He doesn't explicitly talk about California. His supporters do talk about, however, taking all of the Oregon territory from England, you know, going up to and including what present-day British Columbia, like the phrase was 54-40 or fight. So Polk is really what you could just call an incredibly avid expansionist. So, you know, Polk becomes president. He convinces a bunch of members of his own party to agree to Texas annexation. Texas is annexed. And a number of the Democrats who agree to annexing Texas do so, they claim, because Polk told them, well, we will negotiate this border issue. So the point here is that nobody really believes that the land between the Nueces and the Rio Grande belongs to the United States. It's a convenient fiction that expansionists are using to try and basically get more land, but no one really believes it. And then Polk, you know, he sends Zachary Taylor and 4,000 troops down, all the way down to the Rio Grande. And, you know, when you look at the writing of some of Zachary Taylor's officers and troops as they're marching through this disputed territory where there are no Anglo-white Americans at all, is they can't believe that they're there. They know it doesn't belong to them.
My guest is Amy S. Greenberg. She's Edwin Earle Sparks Professor of History and Women's Studies at Penn State University and author of the new book, A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Women's Studies and History Professor Amy S. Greenberg. She teaches at Penn State University, and she's the author of the new book, A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, so Amy, we have this disputed strip of territory between the Rio Grande and the Nueces. We have American troops on the one side. We have Mexican troops on the other side. What happens to give Polk the justification he needs for all-out war with Mexico?
Well, Polk keeps waiting for something to happen. There's, you know, an incredible lag time for news between the border between Texas and Mexico and Washington, D.C. It takes several weeks for news to get back and forth. No one really knows what's going on. But Clay, you know, he's very, very anxious to have a war with Mexico. Now, he doesn't necessarily think that it's going to be a drawn-out war. He doesn't think it's going to be drawn out at all. But he's anxious for something to happen. So he sends the troops down there, and he waits for something to happen. And he goes to his cabinet and basically says to them, look, I'm tired of waiting for something to happen. Mexico's not doing anything. I say that we go to Congress and we declare war. And, you know, his cabinet, some of the members of his cabinet say, okay, yeah, and, you know, some of the members of his cabinet say, well, we really can't go to Congress and declare war without a reason for it, and the reasons that we have are not sufficient. So something has to happen. When Polk was having that conversation with his cabinet, he didn't know it, but 2 weeks before, a number of Mexican troops actually crossed over the Rio Grande and killed a number of American soldiers. So, in fact, Polk's reason for war had actually taken place. He didn't know it. And as soon as he found out that there had been this event, the Thornton Affair, as it was known, he was able to go to Congress and say, American blood has been shed on American soil, and we've done everything we can to avoid war with Mexico, but they've started war with us, so we need to basically grant money for the troops and go forward with this war. He doesn't actually ask Congress to declare war because he just tells them that there's already a war underway. and that's what happens.
What did Lincoln have to say about that?
We don't know what Lincoln had to say about the actual declaration of war. Before the war happened, he made statements saying that he thought that the annexation of Texas was probably a bad idea, again, just sort of echoing what Henry Clay had said. But he doesn't talk about Mexico at all at this time. There aren't actually that many surviving letters from this period of his time, of his life, but none of them talk about Mexico or the declaration of war at all, which is kind of interesting because pretty much everybody was talking about war at this point.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone next to Augustine in Fort Worth. Hi, Augustine.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
See, I was born in Mexico City, so I learned the history from the other side.
Oh, very good.
And up to this day now in Mexico, and that's one of the biggest ideological problems, cultural problems, is that regardless of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo or how Texas was independent or seceded from Mexico, I think the Guadalupe Hidalgo Treaty in the world has been considered the biggest theft of land in the history of the world, and we resent that so much, and it's just something that boggles the mind, you know, that after that we have in 1862 the French imposing an emperor, and then even the English declared war at the time when we were going through the Civil War here in the United States. It was the stroke of luck that they didn't succeed it, but it was just a curse after a curse after a curse. But I think it's the biggest theft of territory in the history of the planet, and nobody seems to understand that.
Well, what do you think about that, Amy?
Well, it's a really interesting perspective, and I can't say that it's wrong. I think that you can definitely make the argument that the entire war resulted in a massive theft of land, and I definitely understand the perspective being voiced here. I know a lot of Mexicans feel this way. As far as the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo itself goes, what I think is actually more notable, I can understand why our caller would not agree with this, what I think is more notable is that it actually wasn't the worst treaty that Mexico could have gotten. The only reason that the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was negotiated at all was because the treaty negotiator, Nicholas Trist, who was sent by Polk to Mexico to get as much land as he could, he was recalled by Polk because Polk actually wanted to take a lot more of Mexico than what we ended up taking. Polk wanted Baja, and he wanted Sonora, and Nicholas Trist thought that this was unfair to Mexico. So even though Trist had been recalled, he was not actually, didn't have any official sanction to negotiate, he went to the Mexican negotiators, and he said, look, I am going to make the best treaty that we can make. If I'm recalled and somebody comes in my place, you are going to lose Sonora, and you're going to lose Baja, and you're going to possibly lose your entire country. So the fact that the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was negotiated at all and was accepted by the U.S. Congress, I think, really shows kind of, I don't want to call it a victory for Mexico, but given the situation that the U.S. Army was occupying Mexico's capital, the fact that Mexico only lost a third of its territory, as opposed to, say, half, is actually kind of remarkable.
How much was Mexico paid by the U.S. at the resolution of the war, and how badly did the Mexican government need that money?
I believe it was $14 million, and they needed the money a lot. Several people have written books in the years since the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, pointing out that given the financial situation in Mexico, had the U.S. just done a better job negotiating, most of this land could have been won from, could have been negotiated from Mexico by treaty. So we didn't actually need a war to get California and to get New Mexico, that eventually Mexico would have sold it because they just had no money whatsoever.
So without bloodshed, you're saying it eventually would have, we would have agreed on a price likely and made those deals.
Yeah. That's what people have said. Now, I don't know how exactly like gold being discovered in California factors into that, but we ended up giving Mexico less than $20 million, which is kind of a strange thing to do at the end of a war that you claim that the other side started. Like, why are you giving them any money at all? But basically, this money was a sort of a payoff to Mexico for a tremendous amount of land, and Mexico definitely needed the money.
And was that the end of the conflict? I mean, there were no more skirmishes after the war was over.
Well, see, the thing that you need to know is that the U.S. actually occupied Mexico City for about 6 months before the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was negotiated. And during that period of time, there was a tremendous amount of guerrilla warfare against the American soldiers who were stationed in Mexico City and throughout Mexico. So there was plenty of time after the point at which the U.S. had sort of supposedly finished the actual warfare of the war, like the military engagement, and when the treaty was finally negotiated. And that was the period when there was the most unsanctioned and difficult violence between the two countries.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Tillman on the line in Dallas. Hi, Tillman.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Very good. My question is, did you look into the Republic of the Rio Grande in considering this period of annexation of Texas?
Which Republic of the Rio Grande?
There was only one. It was a very short-lived attempt by citizens who lived west of the Nueces River,
mm-hmm.
and citizens, Mexican citizens, in the three northern states, Tamaulipas, Nuevo León, and blanking on the third one, and they wanted to have a Texas-style...
Coahuila? Was it Coahuila?
Yeah, Coahuila, correct. They wanted to have a Texas-style independence.
Yeah.
And set up the Republic of the Rio Grande.
Now, what year was that?
It was very short-lived. It was squashed by the Mexican army.
Yeah.
And
but do you know the year, Tillman, that was, by any chance?
I believe that was, let's say, 1840, 1841.
Yep. Another one of Mexico's big problems was that there were constantly these independence movements within Mexico. So various factions and areas of Mexico were constantly threatening rebellion against the central government of Mexico, for a variety of legitimate and not so legitimate reasons. So I'm familiar with the Republic of the Rio Grande. I don't think that it was really a very significant political movement, or that it had much of an effect on the kind of political narrative that I'm telling here, but it was really not atypical at all. So, there were constantly in the Yucatan independence, people voicing independence sentiments and, kind of rebellions, and in Coahuila, same thing. I mean, Texas independence originally arose from a pretty widespread feeling among people in Texas that Mexico was doing nothing for them, and that they'd be better off on their own because Mexico wasn't providing them with economic opportunities, that their political representation was so limited. There were a lot of voices throughout Mexico that were like that, and particularly in the area that Tillman's talking about, there was a lot of anger at Mexico about the fact that the residents there were not being protected from independent Indian tribes, particularly the Comanche, who would lead raids through the area, burning buildings, taking human captives, taking livestock, and Mexico's government was doing nothing to prevent this kind of depredation.
So recognizing that a lot of human lives were lost and a lot of misery was caused, given that at the end of the U.S.-Mexican War, the United States ended up with many of the things that it had wanted, if not everything that it had wanted, what did that do to the Whig Party in particular and all of those Americans in politics who had opposed the war on pragmatic grounds or on moral grounds?
Oh, well, this is very funny. You know, actually, the Whigs ended up winning. They ended up winning this whole thing. And the reason they ended up winning is that all of this new territory that came into the United States, it just exacerbated sectionalism, particularly when California applies to become a state. Southerners really want to see California or a portion of California as a slave-holding state, but people of California don't want to have slavery, by and large. So they, you know, they apply to be an independent, I mean, I'm sorry, they apply to be a, you know, a free state. And the kind of the outrage and the effect of this territory on sectionalism, on especially on Southerners' views that they're not being treated properly by the United States, really ends up being a major factor leading to the Civil War. And the key thing, though, here is that the Civil War is a victory for the Republican Party, and the Republican Party emerged out of the ashes of the Whig Party. The Whig Party falls apart in the early 1850s, not because of anything having to do with the U.S.-Mexico War, but because basically the things that they're talking about don't matter to voters. Voters care about a number of issues that the Whigs and really the Democrats aren't speaking to at all. But the Democratic Party manages to sort of negotiate this a little bit better than the Whigs do. But basically what you have is that in 1854, the Republican Party emerges, which is a fully sectional Northern party committed to limiting or ending slavery. And that's the party that wins the Civil War. So in the years after the Civil War, it's President Ulysses S. Grant, who was a young officer in the U.S.-Mexico War and opposed to the war at that time, who ends up making statements like the Mexican War was the most unjust conflict that's ever been fought by one nation against another. And the Republicans, most of whom used to be Whigs or at least Northern Democrats, end up rewriting history so that the U.S.-Mexico War was this terrible blot on America's honor.
Amy S. Greenberg is Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of History and Women's Studies at Penn State University, and she is author of the new book, A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. Amy, it's been such an interesting discussion. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks, Chris. It's really been a pleasure for me, too.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions for the show. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.